This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
For that, it's 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Out FM.
Welcome to Out FM, New York's only progressive lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer radio hour serving the LGBT communities of New York and beyond. Broadcast live on WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming on WBAI.org, and archived on OutFM.org. My name is Chris Thomas. I will be your host tonight for a very special hour, a kind of continuation of our Pride programming. Hopefully some listeners caught our seven-hour marathon special on Sunday, which was filled with a lot of great stuff, and we have so much to celebrate this weekend, of course, the passage of marriage, and we'll be talking about that, you know, passage of same-sex marriage in New York State. They finally got around to it. but we've succeeded with marriage now, and so we wanted to talk about some issues beyond marriage. So in the first half of the hour, we will be speaking with, we'll be running a piece produced by a young lesbian woman who is also an undocumented immigrant, and she has a conversation with her sister, who is also queer and undocumented, and that's an amazing piece. Her name is Tanya, and she made an amazing piece. And then we'll be hearing some voices from some of this weekend's events, like the Trans Day of Action and a spontaneous rally that happened at Stonewall on Friday, celebrating marriage. And then in the second half of the hour, we will be investigating the case of the Professor Pimp. That's how he's been pilloried in the mainstream media. We'll be talking with sex worker activists about this so-called pimping ring over in the Southwest. But up first is going to be Tanya. In our next segment, Tanya Unzueta Carrasco, 27, interviews her sister, Nadia Sol Ireri Unzueta Carrasco, 24. As Tanya wrote as an introduction to the piece, quote, "We both organized with the Immigrant Youth Justice League. Both are undocumented and queer. We both told our stories of being undocumented publicly at the first National Coming Out of the Shadows Day on March 10th, 2011 at Federal Plaza in Chicago. Then we got arrested together in Washington, D.C. in July of that year as part of a protest for the DREAM Act." So without further ado, Tanya and Nadia.
My name is Tanya Zeta, and I'm 27 years old.
My name is Ireri Unzueta Carrasco, and I'm 24.
So this is my sister. We've been here since
1994.
I was 10 years old.
I was six turning seven.
And we have never really talked about this connection of being undocumented and queer, and I'm undocumented and I'm queer.
Me too. I'm undocumented and I'm queer.
And so we wanted to share a little bit about our stories with each other and with this audience. And so I think that you've been a lot more upfront with our parents about
your
life.
Well, because you came first.
Well, but not necessarily. Because, okay, so I remember coming out to mom and dad, right? We were camping, we were sitting around the fire, and mom was going around saying, "Let's talk about each other's secrets." which I feel like the reason she did that is because she knew and she just wanted me to say it. And so I said, like, "I think I like girls, or I think I may want to date a girl, or I may be already dating a girl." I don't even remember exactly, but I also remember that they were very quiet. I was like, so, like, I was waiting for a response, and mom was like, "Well, it's fine." And I was like, "Great, it's fine, but what does that mean?" Like, I remember feeling like, what does that mean? Does that mean, and I said it, like, does that mean that I can bring people over for dinner and be like, "This is the person that I'm dating. Is that how cool we are?" Or like, "Fine, as in, like, let's never talk about it again." And I remember her saying, like, "Well, just keep introducing them to me as friends." Since then, I'm still a little bit angry at mom, and I feel like it's part of the reason why I don't share a lot of stuff about my relationships and my love life and all those things, because I remember feeling at that moment, like, fine, if she doesn't want to know about it, I won't tell her.
But she's changed.
With you.
No, she's changed. I mean, I think she's tried to talk about this with you, but it's really hard for her. She's talked about it with me and about how she really, really, like, regrets the fact that she said that. I think that she knows that what she did was, like, wrong and pushed you away, and she's not sure how to get back. And I think for me it was really different because you did go first, and because you get to go through everything, and our parents get to make all the mistakes with you, and they try to correct them with me, so I kind of have an easier time in general.
How was it with you?
Well, it wasn't. I think that Mom has been really careful about what she tells me sometimes, in terms of, like, my life outside of, like, friendships. And I didn't directly tell her that I liked girls, but I was party at your house. I don't remember if it was a birthday party or a New Year's party or what. And I wasn't sure how to talk to her at that point, and I felt really sort of sad and dissatisfied with myself. And I, like, felt like crying, so I came downstairs and I cried, and then Mom was worried, and she was like, what's wrong? Like, she was like, well, is it someone that you like? And I was like, yes. I forget if she asked me for a name or if she asked me, like, is it a girl or a boy? I forgot what she said exactly, but I know that, like, I told her who it was, and she was like, oh. And then she sort of tried to comfort me, but I think it was more because I was, like, crying and feeling sad. She was trying to not push me away the way that she pushed you away.
I also think that being undocumented has a lot to do with how our family interacts, mm-hmm. right, and how we talk to each other.
Well, being undocumented and being immigrants, because, like, we don't have any other family in the U.S. except our uncle in Wisconsin and then our uncle in California, and that's, I don't know, I feel like Mom didn't have anyone to rely on for any type of guidance, right, and then our family's background comes from kind of a very strict, I don't know.
Catholic-ish.
Kind of. Yeah.
Mom's side,
yeah.
At least.
Yeah. Yeah. Though I don't think that that's her, but yeah.
And I often wonder whether Mom has told, like, Sandra, for example, and her sisters.
Mm. I don't know.
And if not, like, what kind of support she has.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think her aunt would be supportive. Huh? I think Sandra would be supportive.
Yeah, I mean, I think her aunt would be supportive too, but, and like, it must not be the same to, like, not have your sister here.
Yeah. I think about that sometimes because, like, she calls them, right? And she had a really close relationship with some of her aunts and uncles, and I know that she calls them and sometimes sends them money, but outside of that, like, she doesn't really get to see them. And
yeah, I mean, being undocumented, yeah. By the way, for our audience,
yes,
means that we can't travel back and forth between the border, and so my mom hasn't seen her dad or her mom in 17 years, well, I think, since we've been here. No?
Well, Grandma has come to visit.
But her dad she hasn't seen in 17 years.
In, like, 10 years. Because, I don't know if you remember, I won a prize in fifth grade.
Oh, yeah, she went over there.
Yeah, and we still had, so we came as tourists, right? That's one thing that, in this tier of being undocumented, where you have different privileges, too. Your visa was for 5 years, but mine and Mom's visa was for 10 years. And so when I won the prize, she says that the consulate told her, when she told them about, like, our situation, the consulate told her then we weren't going to get the prize to go to Mexico because that was part of the prize for drawing. And she got really angry and she was like, if my daughter wants to go to Mexico, you know, we're going to go. Like, we get to pick our own risks and you don't get to pick them for us. And so we did. And that was the last time she saw her father. And that was when I was 10, I'm 24. So it's 14 years ago. 14 yeah. Years ago. So she hasn't seen him in 14 years.
And I think for us too, like, I wonder, like, it's so strange to think about how people have, like, cousins that they're friends with,
yeah.
You know, and that, like, I don't know, like, I think the only people who are really, like, constant in my life are Mom and Dad and you. It relates to, like, creating our own families amongst, like, the LGBT community as well, like, yeah. This idea that, like, it's not just blood that connects you, and so I think when you're gay, you have to do that, right, because a lot of times, like, your blood family doesn't like you. But I think that when you're an immigrant, undocumented specifically, you have to do that as well because your family isn't here and, yeah. Like, isn't near or, like, reachable. So how has it been to, like, for you to, like, think about these two identities together?
I'm not sure that I started to think about them together until more recently, where we started doing the coming out of the shadows, as we called it. When I was exploring sort of my identity around my sexuality, I found a really, really supportive community. Really, really nice white people who I love. a lot of them who are queer. And then I had your friends, right, who were also a very welcoming community of not necessarily all white people. So the coming out there was not hard. I think that a lot of my friends were precisely friends because their families were not that supportive. And so we kind of found each other. It's been harder to come out as undocumented in the community of people that I technically work with than it had been for me to come out as queer, because a lot of my friends like knew a whole lot more about like being queer and gay. And we had the Day of Silence thing at school, right? And there was very, like, I don't know, LGBTQ friendly like things, but there wasn't anything around being undocumented. So that was very, very, very different. And so for me, being queer has been easier than being undocumented, right? Like, I haven't faced any particular prejudices from society around it. I haven't felt blocked by anything. If anything, it has allowed me to connect with more people and to, like, have these, like, really deep, nice friendships that I have. And being undocumented has for a long time not been about that. It's been about the things that I can't do. Right? And now I have deep friendships, but it's because of the work that we've been doing, so it's different.
So obviously you didn't have to come out as undocumented to her parents, since they kind of knew, probably better than you did. But
Actually, to go back to her parents, I mean, they knew we were undocumented, right? But I also think that I don't think that they knew what that meant, or that they knew what that would sort of do to us in terms of, or for me at least, in terms of my expectations and my dreams and
psychology.
Psychology and the way that I go about doing things. Like, I don't think that they knew that. And I don't think that they realized that it was something that had become an identity until we started talking about it with them in this last couple of years. So I think so even for them, so it's not like a coming out to our parents is undocumented, but it's definitely like letting them know what it is that we've been through and how that feels. And I don't think that they knew about that.
One of the things that I keep thinking about that's like so strange, if I think you say it out loud, is that if you are like us who are undocumented since we were little, like we've never known what it feels like to vote, for example. We've never known what it feels like to be like participants of a democracy or whatever, right? And like, we can talk about it and theorize about it and know like the US history of politics of blah blah blah, but people talk about how cruel and dictatorships and bad like it is for populations that aren't able to choose their own leaders, right? And like participate in a democracy, and can you imagine they can't even vote? And it's like, I've never voted, and I'm 27 years old, and not because I haven't wanted to, and I'm completely involved in politics and have seen the debates and all of that, but we can't. We can't vote here, and we can't vote in Mexico.
Yeah.
and of course, like, that's one of the experiences that our parents don't have.
Mm-hmm.
Any advice for young undocumented queer people?
Find the people that love you, whether it's your, like, family or whether it's your friends. Find the people that love you, and then if they react in a way you don't think they're going to react, decide whether or not you want to continue to love them and work with them, because the way that I see it, that's really the only like network of support that we have, right? If you like, I don't know, end up without a place to stay, like, it's the people that love you, hopefully, that are going to support you. And if you end up in deportation proceedings, it's the people that love you that are going to help to make all the calls and rally everybody else around. And it's the people that love you that are going to help you get to places when you need to, I don't know, drive somewhere, and just driving by yourself or just being in a car by yourself isn't enough and you might need more support. I don't know. That's the advice that I have.
So on my side, I think another way of surviving is, besides having a network of support, it's organizing. Knowing that we have rights, and knowing that we have the right to have rights. And so whether you're undocumented or you're queer, like, you have the right to exist and you have the right to be happy. And often those rights are already like in the law or in the Constitution. People are stupid. And other times we just have to fight for them. But that's what I mean, like, we have the right to fight for rights.
There's a fire starting in my heart. imagine it's bringing me out the dark. Finally, I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out, and I'll lay your stuff bare. And see how I'll leave with every piece of you. And don't underestimate the things that I would do. 'Cause there's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch and bringing me out the dark.
The scars. That again was a piece produced by Tanya Unzueta Carrasco, interviewing her sister, Nadia Sol Herrera Unzueta Carrasco, 24, about their experiences being both queer and undocumented immigrants originally from Mexico. The song that we're listening to, by the way, is Vicky Martinez, who is an openly lesbian singer currently competing on The Voice, which actually is airing tonight in a little bit. It's a great show. The top contenders are all gay. But anyway, so Tanya wrote an outro to the piece that she wanted to be read, and she emailed, I'd like you to mention one thing about my mom. Quote, even though she's had a hard time understanding her daughters, Tanya Nadia's mom has become very supportive both on LGBT issues and in their immigrant rights organizing. We are particularly grateful for her support of other parents of undocumented youth who have chosen to take risks by participating in civil disobediences, end quote. So thank you, Tanya, very much for that piece, and we're looking forward to other pieces from you. Tanya's a great radio programmer based in Chicago. So up next, we wanted to play a couple highlights from the weekend. One of the weekend's most fabulous events was the Trans Day of Action, which happened on Friday night, and we're about to hear from Imani Henry.
Welcome to the stage, Imani Henry. Give it up!
Come out and come to some of the anti-war this is Naomi Bresser for Out FM at the Trans Day of Action, and I'm speaking to Larry from Aperture, the Asian Pacific Islander Coalition on HIV and AIDS.
Hi. So Aperture is here because we are, right now we're expanding our services to include primary care, and we see that the transgender community is a very underserved community. We want to make sure that transgender people that they have the same access to healthcare as everybody else.
Okay. And are there particular instances where you're seeing people being unserved or underserved?
Definitely underserved. We've seen in other organizations and with other with maybe clinics and doctors within our community who don't understand the transgender experience that they...
Are you talking about the Asian community specifically?
Yeah, I would say within the Asian community. There are a lot of people who don't understand that even transgender people exist or what their lives are like, what their healthcare needs are. So we want to make sure that people in our community... that transgender people in our community are looked after, and we want to ensure the visibility of trans people.
Okay, anything else you want to add? How do people get in touch with Aperture?
They can contact us through our toll-free phone number, 1-866-APERTURE-9, that's 866-274-2429, or they can visit our website at www.aperture.org.
Thank you very much, Larry from Aperture. This is Naomi Bressel for Out FM.
Those again were voices from the Trans Day of Action from this past Friday. And the song we're listening to is a cover of Don't Let Me Down by local out artist Xavier. On Friday night, shortly after marriage passed, there was a spontaneous celebration of hundreds of people who congregated in front of the Stonewall Inn in the West Village. And I just happened to be out and about and sort of heard on the street people saying, "Everybody's going to Stonewall. Everybody's going to Stonewall." So, you know, I went to Stonewall and people were just like celebrating in the street so exuberantly. Like, people were hula hooping. A woman proposed to her partner, and it was just really amazing. And so this is an interview with activist Shep outside of Stonewall on Friday night.
Hey, what's your name?
Shep.
And what were your feelings today when marriage passed?
Well, it was overwhelming. I was at the Stonewall Inn approximately 42 years after the riots that started the whole thing. It was very emotional because I'm of a certain age. I wasn't there 42 years ago, but I'm close to that. And I was actually at the gay synagogue, and Cynthia Nixon was speaking about gay marriage. So it was very inspiring.
What was she saying?
Oh, well, we all knew it was imminent. We all know. Everyone was Twittering and everyone knew it was imminent at any moment. So it was extremely exciting. And then they said, it's going to happen soon. Go down to the Stonewall. It just felt like we were back in the 60s. Go down to the Stonewall. You know, like, oh, man, it was history. So it was very exciting. And it was, I loved the rally because there was no leadership. It was just everyone, everybody was just there. Everybody, all young, all kinds of people, all races, men, women. It was a beautiful thing. And it was wonderful. Everyone was congratulating everybody for the hard work we put in over four decades. And finally, it came to fruition, you know. And at the Stonewall, where it all began, I was choked up. It was really beautiful.
Cool. Well, happy Pride.
Oh, thank you. Well, congratulations. You made it.
Yeah.
that was a really silly, yeah. I was really feeling the celebration on Friday night. My name is Chris Thomas. You're listening to Out FM on WBAI 99.5 FM. We wanted to play like one more little tidbit. Recently there was a celebration of the out gay poet Tim DeLugos at the Poetry Project. And so here are Patricia Spears-Jones and Jaime Manrique talking a little bit about Tim and reading a little bit of his poetry.
I'm Patricia Spears-Jones, and Tim was not a historical figure, but like for David and many others, he was a friend and colleague, and I am grateful to him, so I'm reading a very funny poem by him out of great gratitude for all the help he gave me when I was here as the program coordinator way back in the day. And he left too soon. He just left too soon. That's all I got to say. If I were Bertolt Brecht, page 268 in your hymnal, I take a bath, first of all. Then I throw away those drab and ratty suits I'm always photographed wearing. Buy some new threads, and while I'm at it, get myself in shape at the nearest holiday health spa. Next, I trim the fat off my plays, getting rid of the didactic, boring passages that make me such a German artist. I develop a modest sense of humor and a sense of modesty and treat the ladies better. They're people too. If I hated California as much as I say, I leave and go somewhere I like better, but I love California. So that would eliminate a lot of grief. I'd shave the silly mustache, get a tan, and turn my life into a sane and happy one, all before I went out for my sauerkraut and Knockwurst into the Weimar night.
Jaime Manrique. Loon dance. My grandfather speaks. In the morning, at the first false light, the loons danced upon the lake for us. Your Uncle Tom, who died when you were small, and I had hiked from Scow the afternoon before. We set off through the hills and reached the lake in time to see the sun go down. It hung above the pines and stretched our shadows longer and longer behind us. It dropped behind the trees and tarnished the whole forest. And when it went away and the birds flew home for the night, we built a fire and watched the smoky flames cast shadows on the lake. We slept after lying a while listening to the water. No dark corners to watch, but darkness all around, and just the dying gold of our dark pine fire to know directions by. In the blue half light, we woke hours later. The dew had started to grow. Grayly down on the lake, the loons were dancing. They threw out their wings, turning and turning, half obscured by the mist. They whirled in rows like shakers and were dressed like Mennonites in their drab feathers. By the time the sun came back to see their dance, they'd flown away. Tom and I had bobbed our heads like loons to keep from being seen. We watched from behind the blackberry bush, both afraid we'd sneeze, and both embarrassed to be present at a loon dance that early in the morning. I wonder, Tom said later, as we walked along an orange needle path toward home, if, after doing whatever loons do during the day, they come to dance in darkness on the lake before they sleep. I said I didn't know, and thought about it in silence as your uncle and I descended the hill and walked beneath the pine trees towards Cohegan. Thank you.
That again was Jaime Manrique and Patricia Spears-Jones reading the poetry of Tim DeLugos. That'd be like a nice little interlude. We are listening to Khaki King, another out artist based in Brooklyn. The time is 7:30. You are listening to Out FM on WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live on WBAI.org and archived on OutFM.org. And I should say that we have a lot of bonus material on OutFM.org, our website, right now, so definitely check that out for more stories from undocumented youth. Tanya, who we heard from at the beginning of the hour, organized an event called Coming Out of the Shadows, and we have a lot of stories from that, as well as a lot of other great stuff. When we come back in the second half of the hour, we will be having a conversation about the pimping and the broader context of criminalization of sex work. Last week, up now we're going to have a conversation about pimping in the broader context of the criminalization of sex work. Last week, David C. Flory, a physics professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, was arrested on 40 counts of promoting prostitution. The allegedly pimping professor was nabbed while sitting at a Starbucks in Albuquerque. Authorities say Flory, who works in Teaneck, New Jersey, and has a vacation home in Santa Fe, ran a website called Southwest Companions, which provided safe social networking for 1,400 sex workers and their clients. Flory is out on bail, but since his arrest, four other men and one woman have also been charged, including University of New Mexico President Chris Garcia, and at least three other people are under investigation. The mainstream tabloid media has had a field day with this story, running headlines like, quote, "Pimping professor ran cyber prostitution ring," and "Prof Pimp tried out the merch." We have two guests on the phone to discuss this case and the broader context of pimping, harm reduction, and the criminalization of sex workers. Jill McCracken is an educator, activist, and researcher. She is an assistant professor at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg, whose research involves street-based sex workers. She's also a board member of Sex Workers Outreach Project USA, or SWAP USA, we might call it in this interview, which is a national social justice network dedicated to the fundamental human rights of sex workers and their communities, focusing on ending violence and stigma through education and advocacy. Jill, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you. Welcome.
Thanks.
And also on the phone is Liz Coplin, board chair of SWAP USA. Liz, a former sex worker herself, is a longtime activist and sex worker advocate based in Arizona. Welcome, Liz.
Hi, how are you?
Great, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with OutFM. So Liz, I wanted to start with you. You know David Flory. What was your first reaction when you heard about his arrest on charges of promoting prostitution?
Well, honestly, my first reaction was disgust.
Mm.
I mean, people are dying out there, and why are we taking away the very few safety networks that are out there for sex workers and focusing on David, who, from my knowledge, was only helping to ensure the safety of these workers?
Mm.
There have been 13 bodies found about 2 years ago in a remote area near Albuquerque. It's the largest crime scene in Albuquerque to date that I know of, and many, if not all, of these workers were involved, women were involved in street work. The women started being reported missing in 2000, and the killer still has yet to be found. So why are we not concentrating on that instead of focusing on David, whose only agenda that I know of was to protect and help bring safety into the lives of sex workers?
For listeners who might not have followed the story, can you kind of clarify how the site worked? Or works? Is it still running? It's not running, right?
I don't know if it's still running, actually. This website and others like them, they're a safe place for workers to share information about potentially unsafe clients. For example, if a worker is raped, robbed, or beaten, we can easily pass that information back and forth to each other in hopes of protecting ourselves from violent people. If the cops are not going to help us stay safe, we really need to do it ourselves. And that's exactly why sites like these are so important. And to the best of my knowledge, David did nothing to promote prostitution. What I heard on that site over and over again was safe, sane, and consensual. Be safe, ladies. Safety first. Those were the messages that I got from that site. And I think those are really important messages, not just for sex workers, but in an everyday life.
Mm. And sorry to interrupt, yeah.
I was going to say my stance on sex work is that it's my body and my choice. Mm-hmm. And I also feel that as a human being, I deserve the same respect and safety in the workplace as anyone else. And I feel like sites like these help to offer that safety that we all really deserve.
Mm-hmm. Professor Jill McCracken, what was your first reaction, or what is your analysis of this in general?
Well, my first reaction was to shock. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with Craigslist and the erotic services that have been recently shut down. But I was shocked because there was a lot of pressure against Craigslist in terms of shutting down those erotic services. But certainly the owners or creators of Craigslist were not arrested, and they certainly weren't put on trial for prostitution or the promotion of prostitution. So it just takes this to a whole another level. And like Liz, I mean, I'm outraged that we are spending tax dollars on these kinds of situations. I think that sites like these, as Liz says, not only allow people to exchange information and try to keep themselves safe, but it gives them space and time where they can talk to clients, get a better understanding of what the client wants, what they're willing to do, safety issues, whether it's safe sex, whatever it is. What happens when these sites get shut down, which I'm not sure if this one's still going or not, but I would be absolutely shocked if it were, is the people that are using them will be forced into the streets. Mm. And we know that people, women and men on the streets, it's often much, much more dangerous to negotiate something safely, both for law enforcement, but more importantly, with the client. They just have far fewer resources available to them.
Hmm. And sort of something that you touched on is what is pimping? I mean, we've got different legal definitions state by state, but I mean, there is a phenomenon of, you know, violent coercive pimping that presumably you're both critical of, but what's the sort of distinction between that and what he was doing?
Well, I think that what's been happening here is sensational media, mm-hmm. In the sense that, yes, first of all, we have to kind of question the word pimp, mm-hmm. Because it gets thrown around a lot in popular culture, and I don't think that it can be very useful. Oftentimes, a person, a woman or man, will have somebody watching out for them, looking out for them, a partner, a friend, whatever. That can be construed as a pimp, according to laws, right? What I think you're referring to is when somebody's being held against their will. Mm-hmm. And if someone's being held against their will or being forced to do something or act in certain ways against, has someone there that's holding them up against their will, then of course there needs to be penalties for that. And we have laws. I don't think that that would necessarily involve the word pimp. I would use a more specific language that would talk about any person who is forcing, coercion, those kind of things, forcing someone to do something against their will.
Mm. And Liz, when we were talking earlier today on the phone, you were talking about the different types of sex workers. Can you sort of let listeners know that important point?
Yeah, I think it's, there's been this huge panic around trafficking sex workers. And I think we need to differentiate the different types of sex workers. Obviously, there are, trafficked sex workers. Now, we all agree that anyone who's lied or forced into sex work is wrong and should be stopped. Nobody that I know of, of course, including Swap USA, would say it's okay to traffic another into sex work. However, there are other forms of consensual sex work, one of those being for financial reasons or survival sex work. And many of these sex workers might feel they have no other options. And maybe they don't, which is a problem in and of itself. So perhaps addressing the poverty issues or offering exit strategies for these sex workers if they're so inclined. Then there's also the sex workers who really do enjoy the work and feel that they're helping society by offering intimacy and affection to those who otherwise might not have access to it. These sex workers may also feel a sense of empowerment over their own bodies and the choices that they've made. And I think the key issue here is that it seems the entire nation is so focused on trafficking sex workers that we're forgetting that the vast majority of sex work in the United States is consensual. And we really do need to differentiate between consensual sex workers from those being trafficked.
And if I could jump in, one of the things that, do you mind, Chris?
No, no, please.
One of the things that I find most ironic about this, you know, these kinds of headlines is talking about him as a pimp. You know, you're basically turning it around. A pimp, if you want to use that word, is somebody who is exploiting. My understanding of Professor Flory or David was that he was trying to create a space that was safe, wasn't even profiting, if my understanding is correct, off of this site. So it's completely opposite of what a pimp would be doing. And yet we're using this language because I guess we want to sensationalize it in the media and basically make him look like this terrible person, when in fact, yeah, he's considered a hobbyist, which I know Liz can talk more about, but he was trying to create a space for people to be safe.
Again, we are speaking with two members of the board of the Sex Workers Outreach Program, Liz Coplin, an activist and former sex worker, and Professor Jill McCracken. Jill, your research, as you were just starting to talk about, is about the language that sort of informs the debates around sex work. And I was wondering if you could do a little bit of a media critique, like about the media coverage of this case.
Sure. Again, I'm not, certainly I'm not aware of all the media that's been covered, but even in the two headlines that you read early on, and I don't have access to them right in front of me, but I remember the one about sampling the merch.
Yeah.
And pimping professor ran cyber prostitute. One of the things that I look at is language on both sides, both the language that we use to talk about these things, so headlines in newspapers would count, but also the material reality that occurs on the other side. What kind of laws are written? What kind of policies are written? Grants, funding, that kind of thing. So how does this actually relate in terms of material conditions for people's lives? So when you look at this kind of headline, pimping professor and professor tried out the merch, it's so offensive. I mean, we are referring to a person, an individual person, as merchandise, and we are referring to this person as a pimp when, again, promoting prostitution, whatever that legal definition is, I haven't read the law, it's not the same thing as a pimp. So you're just trying to create sensationalism. One of the things that the focus is here is on this person, this man, who we are trying to penalize and make look like this terrible person, as opposed to, let's focus on the women. Let's focus on safety. You could rephrase this, headline, if you wanted to, and you could talk about safety, women's rights, or sex workers' rights now compromised because site has been shut down. What kind of different emphasis would that leave? Is it as exciting? I don't know, right? But it definitely changes the emphasis from penalizing or venalizing this person to what's going on for women's safety. And if we claim that we're really interested in, I shouldn't say women because men and women participate.
And transgender people of transgender experience.
Transgendered, exactly. If we care about people's safeties, then we need to follow through with that, whether it be in our headlines, whether that be in the way that our laws are enacted, and this does not show anything that is related to caring about people's safety.
And that certainly was not the case when Craigslist shut down its adult services section last year. Liz, how do you assess the impact of Craigslist being shut down?
I feel like the shutdown of Craigslist did nothing but harm sex workers. Mm. Again, like Jill touched on, by taking away the few screening methods that are available. And it just honestly, it feels as if law enforcement is trying to push us offline, away from safety, and into street-based work where there are fewer safety methods utilized. You know, when you're on the streets, you only have moments to make your decision if a client is safe or not. Mm. And you're then often taken to a remote location of the client's choice where you're literally on your own. Forcing Craigslist to shut down, in my opinion, is only giving rapists and murderers further opportunities to easily prey on victims.
Mm. And just concretely, like how, like what are the screening processes like online? Like how does it help? Like how does something, a site like the Southwest Companions help?
I would say in answer to that question, this is Jill, that although I'm not as familiar with specific screening techniques, and I don't even know that people would want to necessarily talk about that, okay, having space and time is an incredible resource whenever anybody makes a decision, listening to your instincts, listening to your body, and just having that physical distance. That is an incredible resource. Also having the safety of how deciding where you're going to go, deciding what you're willing to do, all of those things add to your safety in terms of making a one-on-one connection. Who knows you're there? How will they know? Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your work at SWAP? Either of you, Liz or Jill?
Sure. We are primarily interested in, we're a sex worker rights organization. We're very interested in education and advocacy. We have several different projects ongoing. We have chapters in cities all over the country, SWAP New York, SWAP Tucson, I couldn't name them all, SWAP Chicago. And basically they are for sex workers and allies and activists to get together and educate themselves and fight for human rights. Mm. And we have a hotline so that, and I wish I could had that number, Liz. I don't know if you have it handy. We have a hotline that people can call if they have any kind of concerns about sex work, problems, partners, whatever it is, they can call. And we also are working on a project called Safe Call, which has not been let out yet, but will actually help anybody, not just sex workers, make them safer by being able to leave a recorded message saying, if I don't call you back within 30 minutes, please call the cops or please call this, that kind of thing. So our primary concern are individual human rights, and our primary concern are civil rights. Mm. And oftentimes because sex workers are marginalized, their rights are trampled on. Mm. And so what we do is we try to look at places, and it's sex worker-led. Allies are definitely encouraged, but it's sex worker-led, and we want sex workers at the forefront because they're the ones that know the issues the most intimately at all levels, whether it's the street, escort, dancers, whatever it is. There's a huge venue of sex work out there.
Mm, thank you. And again, we are speaking with two members of SWAP USA, which is the Sex Workers Outreach Project, Liz Coplin and Jill McCracken. Liz, something that we touched on that you and I talked about on the phone was this idea of hobbyists. I think a lot of people don't know what that means because David Flory has been portrayed in the media as a hobbyist. Like, what does that mean?
A hobbyist is just a simple term for a client. Nothing more than that.
Oh, okay. I see.
And I don't know that David is or is not a hobbyist.
I see.
I wouldn't know that.
Yeah, but so that just gets into the question, I guess, of what. Why was he being portrayed as a pimp? Because, like, Jill, like, you were just talking about some activities that it almost seems like if you support sex workers in any way, you could be prosecuted under promoting prostitution. Like, maybe, I mean, is that something that you grapple with at SWAP? Like, is the sweep of law enforcement that inclusive just to sort of criminalize every harm reduction practice that sex workers are trying to do?
That's a good point. I mean, one of the things that I know you guys are dealing with in New York right now, there is a, and I'm not going to get all the language right, a bill, I think, to condoms are used as evidence. This is a harm reduction practice, right? We actually want to encourage safe sex, not we as in SWAP, but we as in society want to encourage safe sex. And yet if you're caught carrying too many condoms, that can be used against you as evidence.
Mm.
So there's a bill right now that's trying to overturn that, and you can get more information on SWAP New York's website about that. But that's one of the issues that I don't think Swap is concerned with, I don't think we, that'll be the next headline, right? Mm. Swap as the pimp. Mm. I don't think we're concerned with being pimps, but you bring up an excellent point that when you look at harm reduction practices and you look at safe practices and you say, how far can people go to try to, what, create, I don't know, some kind of morality? There are issues in terms of privacy, what people do in their bedrooms, what consensual adults do, and there is a layer of morality that gets covered over that in terms of this situation with Flory. Again, they were not arresting Craig or whoever else creates these sites, so it's shocking to me that we can take it that far.
Mm. Well, we have to wrap up. Do either of you have any sort of final thoughts for listeners, like before we wrap up the interview?
Yeah, I would like to comment just on like the money that's spent on these types of things. I think there's several things that could be done instead that would be a lot more effective.
Mm.
First off, I strongly believe that SWAP and other sex worker rights organizations should be in collaboration with anti-trafficking groups. I mean, after all, our agenda is pretty much the same, is to help trafficked victims get out of the situations they're in and to keep people safe. Secondly, I really strongly believe that if sex work were to be decriminalized, it would be beneficial for all. I mean, if an instance where, you know, you ran across an underage trafficked victim, whether your client or another sex worker, right now you really don't have any recourse. If you go to law enforcement, you're afraid you're going to be arrested. If you're a client, you're afraid you're going to be outed to your family or your work area. If we were to decriminalize sex work, we would have that access to be working with law enforcement to keep us all safe. And I think that's, you know, really important. Right now it's just non-existent.
Such a great point. Jill, did you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, just wanted to say that I think it's important for everyone to consider individual people first and foremost. And although you may be for or against criminalization of prostitution, I think it's really important to listen to the people that are actually most intimately involved. And I think considering individual safety and if laws make things more difficult for people, that we need to consider that. And we also need to hold our police officers and our state to task and accountable for the kinds of crimes that they're going after. And is this really where we want our funds spent?
Mm. Great, great points. Thank you so much, Liz and Jill McCracken, both from SWAP USA. And for listeners who are interested, we have on outfm.org many stories, many interviews with sex workers. We've been covering this a lot, so check us out. And this will also be on outfm.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Liz Coplin and Jill McCracken from SWAP USA. The song we were just listening to was by out artist Michelle Andighiacello. I wanted to end the show. Oh, by the way, this is Chris Thomas on Out FM on WBAI 99.5 FM. And I wanted to end the show with another voice of a young undocumented youth, young undocumented LGBT youth from an event in Chicago called Coming Out of the Shadows. This is Ralpha.
Hi, my name is Rafa. I'm 21 years old. I've been gay all my life, but out for 8. I got my mom on the couch while the rest of the family was in the kitchen, and I just let it out. Soy gay. She cried before she even said a word. Then I cried. She thought it was a phase. Then when I told her it wasn't, she said, but I had been sexually abused, and it was all her fault. I assured her this wasn't the case. Of course, then, it had to be hormonal problems. We went to the doctor, then a counselor, and only after this was she convinced that this was just the way it was going to be. She told my dad, despite me desperately asking her not to, but he ended up being supportive in his own way. Still, however, we've never talked about it. Now, in college, after about a year of friendship, one of my friends told me that he had something very important to tell me. He asked if I had seen milk. I thought he was going to be gay, but he wasn't, and I wasn't ready to respond to what he said. He said, "I'm undocumented." I listened, but then I said, "You're not gay? Like, what is this?" We always talked about the similarities between being queer and being undocumented, but we also shared our different fears. And it was these conversations that made us less afraid. I feel no shame today about being gay, and I'm not shy about standing up for myself or my friends. There are 5 self-identified gay people in my family, and I'm the only one out. However, being unafraid and unapologetic about myself has inspired them to slowly come out. Some of them have told their brothers and sisters. And now my mom, too, is making that transition. But it was the undocumented youth movement, the undocumented and unafraid, that facilitated my movement away from self-hate and self-oppression. And understanding, although I was gay, that coming out was the most basic agent of internal and external change. I'm queer, unafraid, and apologetic, and I'm also an ally. And it may be hard, but if you're in this room, you already have the support of all of us. So come out no matter what or how many things you have to come out about.
That again was Ralpha from Coming Out of the Shadows in Chicago earlier this year. I'm Chris Thomas. This is thank you so much for listening to Out FM on WBAI 99.5 FM. You can hear more pieces from us on outfm.org. Thanks so much to Michael J. Haskins, Max Schmid, Tanya Unzueta, Naomi Brussel, and all our guests. And coming up next is Ecologic on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Tuesday, June 28th, the WBAI Community Advisory Board will be holding an open meeting at the 6th Street Community Center, which is located at 638 East 6th Street between Avenue B and C. The theme will be, what next in terms of premiums? What will work at the station in order to support it? That's at the 6th Street Community Center on June 28th at 7 o'clock.
Promises, promises, I'm up through with promises.
There are other effects of climate change besides sea level rise, hurricanes, tornadoes, and polar bear declines. There are provable local consequences as well. How has climate change affected the breeding ranges and ecosystems of resident and migrant birds? Tune into WBAI this Tuesday to hear Dr. Morgan Tingley of Princeton University tell Ken Gale about a 6-year study, or you could call it a 100-year study, to find out just that. This Tuesday, June 28th at...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.